It was about 2 days before Christmas, and I had been on top of a very tall mountain and had been left there with just a platoon to cover a whole company's front. And we were exhausted, and we were trying to do the work of a company, pretending to be a company, and we'd gotten hit a couple of times, and I'd lost three people to a terrible friendly fire incident. And this was the first time I was actually in command all by myself of a fire base and the platoon, because the company had left. So this was really my sort of first initiation into combat. And it was just before Christmas. And so I thought I'd tell you a little, I'd read you a bit about what happened on that day. 2 days before Christmas, the fog lifted just enough to allow a single chopper to work its way up to us, a dangerous journey, squeezing beneath the cloud ceiling just a few feet above the jungle-covered ridges. Along with food, water, mail, and ammunition came the battalion chaplain. He had brought with him several bottles of Southern Comfort and some new dirty jokes. I accepted the Southern Comfort, thanked him, laughed at the jokes, and had a drink with him. Merry Christmas. Inside, I was seething. I thought I'd gone a little nuts. How could I be angry with a guy who had just put his life at risk to cheer me up? And didn't the Southern Comfort feel good on that rain-raked mountaintop? Years later, I understood. I was engaged in killing and maybe being killed. I felt responsible for the lives and deaths of my companions. I was struggling with a situation approaching the sacred in its terror and contact with the infinite, and he was trying to numb me to it. I needed help with the existential terror of my own death and responsibility for the death of others, enemies and friends, not Southern Comfort. I needed a spiritual guide.
You know, what's compelling about that paragraph that you just read is what it leads to, the mm-hmm. discussion that that it leads to in what it is like to go to war, your book, because of the suggestion that war is a spiritual experience and you need a spiritual guide.
Right. I know most people are aghast when I mention that thesis, but the first thing about it is that what is spiritual experience about? What are religions about other than death? That if we didn't die, I don't think we would probably do much of that sort of activity. And here you are, you have a 19-year-old who has been raised in a basically Judeo-Christian culture, thou shalt not kill, and they're all decent kids, and that they believe it firmly. And then suddenly they are transported, usually to some foreign country, and asked to kill for their country, which is totally the opposite of everything that they've ever done. And like I say, it's when you kill another human being and you sort of wake up to the fact, which usually happens after you do it, you don't just have a wound to your body or your psyche from the war, you actually have a wound to your soul. And looking at warfare, because it does deal with death, and 19-year-olds cast in the role of the gods, only the gods really should be the ones deciding who lives and who dies. And yet, you know, 19-year-old squad leaders have to tell a kid, you're on point today, and maybe he dies. Or we take the life of other people in combat, or even sacrificing your own life, which is the Christian God.
What's hard for me to talk about is what's hard for you to talk about, I think. This is not abstract. For you.
No.
This is a discussion that people might have sitting around a room with a couple of beers or might have in their church mm-hmm. with somebody talking about morality. But you're talking about a time in your life when this was very real
yes.
and nobody talked about it.
Right. We have this amazing code of silence in this country around anything that has to do with death. I mean, even the chaplain that showed up here didn't want to talk about death. And we also have a code of silence about combat. I mean, people are afraid to talk to the veterans because, oh, I don't want to disturb him. And the veteran is afraid to talk because he doesn't want to be judged. I mean, we do terrible things in war. And then the decent kid comes back and he would like to talk about it, but he's afraid that, you know, if he says what he really did, people are going to go, you know, definitely ruined dinner, you know. So this combined code of silence around death and combat just isolates veterans. It's tough.
And even for you now, having thought a lot about this and talked a lot about this, it's hard for you not to make a joke.
Right.
It definitely spoils dinner.
Yeah. I have to lighten it up. Exactly. Yeah. It's because, you know, if you get too serious in this culture, it's there's something that you shouldn't go there, because we like to avoid the tough stuff. You know, I mean, it just occurs to me, like, the way that we actually approach spirituality in our current culture is it's mostly sort of like, you know, we like Christmas. We don't like Good Friday. You know, the Tibetan Buddhas have monsters, and the early Native Americans had ritual torture, and the Aztecs had ritual torture. I mean, there are dark sides to religion, but our culture doesn't look at them. And so that's the other thing, is that when we talk about going into combat, it is so intense. And it occurred to me that it might just be, and I'm no expert, but it might just be the opposite side of the same coin.
Well, what confused me about the arguments that you go on to make is precisely that point. You talk about other cultures mm-hmm. in which the acts and maybe the discussions are much more vivid.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that you're suggesting that our soldiers might be healthier if we not only talked about it, but had a more, well, for lack of a better word, a crueler introduction to what was going to be asked of them.
Yes, I wouldn't use the word cruel. I would use the word darker. It's this world of opposites that we definitely live in, light and dark, and accepting that both are part of life, part of the spiritual experience, is important, because you're going to ask these kids to go into the dark side. And if they've never had anybody even talk to them about it, much less live in a culture where, you know, I had one Indian friend of mine once tell me, I mean, I worked over in India, and he said, Carl, he says, I think Americans are the only people on the planet who think that death is an option. And we do sort of have that attitude, you know, and we have to, I think, spend some time, because what I'm arguing is that the 19-year-old isn't going to, you know, be enlightened and go into combat sort of like our ideal of the samurai soldier or something. But if you can tell him ahead of time, you're going to experience this, you're going to think about this, this is going to happen to you after you come back. It may not happen the first week. It may happen a decade later. But to sort of give them the warning signs of what they're going to face, they will recognize it faster. And I dealt with PTSD for four decades. If someone had told me what was coming down the road, I would have probably recognized it 20 years earlier, saved a lot of problems.
Well, and what you're talking about is training that sounds harsh,
yeah.
But you're talking about two periods in a soldier's life, man or woman,
mm-hmm.
the in-combat
right.
time and the post-war
right.
career time. The PTSD
yeah.
is something that everybody is aware of, but again, hardly anybody talks about
right.
now.
Yeah. No, it's
And
it's
you think brutal. that training before going into combat, being more aware,
mm-hmm.
Will both help you kill
mm-hmm.
and help you survive the killing?
I don't think it'll help you kill. I think that the way that you kill is that you don't want to take another human life. So the way that we sort of trick ourselves in combat is that we sort of get into the mental state that person that you're about to kill is actually not a person. You know, words like gook, towelhead, ragtop, damn Yankee, you name them, and nigger, Jew. We have all these things in our culture that allows us to make the other person a non-human. I call it pseudo-speciating. It's a big word, but basically it's just what it allows you to do is pull the trigger on somebody who at that moment you don't really think is human, because if it was human, you would hesitate, and it would be much harder. I had an experience where this broke down, and that haunted me some 20 years after the war.
You talk about this in the book.
I do.
You can still remember looking into the eyes,
eyes of a man
who was as scared as you were.
Exactly. And we happened to just be no more than about 10 or 15 feet apart. And he had been throwing grenades at me and my friends and had wounded badly one of my friends. And we were throwing them back and had killed one of his friends who was in the hole. And I had snuck up on the side so I could get a shot at him to stop this. And I was looking at him right across the barrel of the M16, and he stood up with the hand grenade already ready to pull the primer, and we locked eyes. And that's very unusual. And I kept saying to myself, and I was whispering out loud, I wish I could speak Vietnamese. Don't throw it. If you don't throw it, I won't pull the trigger. Don't throw it. If you don't pull it, I won't pull the trigger. I did not want to do that. He just snarled at me and threw it. And I pulled the trigger. 20 years later, I mean, I was busy that day. I mean, that just went right out of my mind as soon as that was. In fact, I talk in the book, I felt bad because I bucked my shot and hit the dirt in front of him instead of a clean shot. I mean, weird thoughts. But 20 years later, I'm driving down I-5, you know, 2 in the morning, country music on the radio, a nice little bubble of warmth in the car. And those two eyes appeared in the windshield.
How old were you?
At that point, I was probably, 45.
How old were you when you took the shot?
23.
And you'd been in country for a while?
Oh, yeah, I'd been in country for a while.
This wasn't a fresh meeting.
No. This was where I said that it broke down. Because when you're generally, certainly in jungle warfare, you hardly ever see who you're shooting at. And even if you're, even if you're just a couple meters away, I mean, it's really thick foliage. And they're, of course, trying to hide, which you are trying to do, too. But it was at this moment that it broke down. I saw those eyes. And then it was my unconscious saying, Marlanus, you got to deal with this. And that was a large impetus for writing this book.
What could you have done? Because that's a lot of what you're trying to figure out now, 40 years later. What could you have done, do you think, to prepare better for that moment? And would it have made any difference? Would those eyes still be staring at you?
I think that what I could have done is had been warned ahead of time about what the actual psychological mechanisms are going to be when you are in combat. This thing about slipping in and out of the enemy is an animal, the enemy is not an animal, because that in itself is helpful because you can recognize sooner what you've done, and you can begin to incorporate it into your psyche. What happens is that to protect yourself, you just wall it off completely, and you just stuff it. You stuff it so far down that you're not even in touch with it. But all these other symptoms start coming out. All the things of PTSD, all the the tears, the sudden rages. I mean, these are things that are going to happen, but they would happen sooner and under more control if you could sort of step back yourself and say, oh, okay, here's Carl, and he's starting to exhibit what they told me about. In other words, it's that sense of being able to watch yourself, which a lot of the more mystical people talk
about.
Of course,
this is not new to the warrior world, is it? I read a book several years ago about American soldiers going to World War II into North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the author of that book, they were not good soldiers when they went. They had, he said, to learn to hate the enemy when they were there. And the army, he said, learned that lesson and from then on taught what you're now saying is a problem, to hate the enemy, to obscure their humanity in order to be able to fight them aggressively.
I disagree with him. I mean, I never hated the North Vietnamese Army. I never hated any of them. I in fact, and most Marines admired them. They were darn good soldiers. They were good. But the fact is that the hatred is one of the things that I think will get you in trouble. If you kill somebody hating them, you've got more on your conscience than if you do it because you had to get the job done, because you had to, achieve the mission, keep your friends alive, keep yourself alive.
Take the emotion out of it.
Yes, try to. You're going to get so... I mean, the major emotion of war during combat is extreme excitement. I mean, it's a crack cocaine high, but the costs are crack cocaine costs and sadness. If someone says, what's my overall feeling from a war? The feeling is sadness because of all the death and destruction, both sides.
Well, and this is the thing when you come home, when you stop being a soldier,
right,
or even if you stay in the Army but you're no longer in combat,
right,
that you have to deal with. All that time when you took the emotion out of it in order to do your job,
mm-hmm,
in order to make it a job instead of a passion. It sounds as though that comes roaring back once you're out of the zone. The emotion comes pouring back in. It's almost as though you have to experience all of that emotion that you kept out.
Yeah, I don't know if you have to. I did. Writing this book, I'd have snot on the keyboard from bawling my eyes out because of trying to sort of, it would come roaring out. And I suspect that is the way it works. You can't get the job done if you're completely in the throes of an emotional state. That's not going to work. And so you cut it off. But on the other hand, you still are a human being and you have experienced this. And in order to integrate it without damage to yourself, you do have to start to feel it, because the way that a lot of people take care of it, which we need to watch for in our culture, is numbing through alcohol, drugs, suicide. It's a good way to stop feeling things. So that's why it's important, again, that you tell the young soldier that it's going to be okay. You're going to feel this, but that's good. This is called getting through it, not, oh, you're terrible, you're breaking down. And we have a lot of that problem. I mean, the current military has a problem. Guys are afraid to go in and get help for PTSD because if it says unstable on their record, they're not going to get a promotion. So, I mean, it's very hard. I think there's a definite debate going on in the military now. The other side is coming up, and I think will eventually work its way through and succeed.
Well, this is partly what's fascinating about the whole discussion, because it's important. I mean, maybe the best solution to all of this would be the thing that can't happen. Let's not have any more war,
right.
Okay?
Yeah.
No more soldiers. We're going right. to...
That would be
but,
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just don't believe we're going to
okay,
be there
Okay, let's
for a
push
while.
That to one
that's
side, because
right.
none
yeah.
of us really believes yeah. That that's going to happen. Although, frankly, toward the end of the book, you talk about a discussion you had, I think you had, with Terry Waite.
Yeah. I didn't have a discussion with him, but Terry Waite is a hero of mine. And
for those who don't remember Terry Waite, maybe you could...
Well, he was an envoy of the Archbishop of Canterbury and had gone to Lebanon to deal with terrorists and he was there, he is a man of God. He's a part of the Anglican Church, and he had gone there to negotiate, and they had taken him captive, and they treated him brutally. I mean, they chained him to a bed. He was captive for something like 5 years, no idea what was going on. And one day in his captivity, one of his guards had left an AK-47 on the top of the toilet in the bathroom, and Terry had gone in there, and there it was, a loaded weapon. And he looks at that weapon, and he knew that if he picked it up and shot the guard, he would be free. He walked back and handed that weapon back to the guard. And that was where I understood that Terry Waite is a brave man, incredibly brave man. But what he said was everything that I had been trying to talk to these people about would have been destroyed if I had acted in the other way. Now, a warrior would have pulled the trigger and gotten Terry out of there. There's two different ways of being in the world, and both are admirable in their own way. And so I like to point out the difference between, not all warriors are brave, and there's a lot of brave non-warriors.
Well, and part of what's interesting about that is that it leads you to try to figure out what the difference is between
yes.
a civilian and a soldier.
Right.
And you try to be both.
Yeah.
You try to be a civilian, go to be a soldier, and then it's the return to being a civilian.
Right.
And you need to understand it somehow. Nobody's training us to do that.
Well, nobody's thinking about it very much even. But, I mean, my definition I call it a warrior because you have to cover Marines and soldiers and airmen and sailors, and so I had to have a generic name, but is that it's somebody who will take a side. Just take side. These are my people. you are trying to hurt my people, so I'm on this side. And they are willing to use violence to stop the other side from using violence, and they're willing to accept getting killed or maimed to do that. And I like to point out, it's very different from a police officer who can't choose sides. They have to be on the side of the law. And that's even though they also subject themselves to, you know, perhaps being killed, and they also use violence, they're not acting as warriors. They're acting as police officers. And we get that confused. I think we've gotten into wars where we actually should have had police officers in there, 35 to 40-year-olds with that kind of judgment, not your 19-year-old warrior who, in my opinion, is the best warrior because he doesn't think deeply. He does the job.
Is that also true of the warrior whose job is to sit at a computer in Washington, D.C. and guide a missile to kill?
I had to think about that hard, but I come down on this side. I mean, back in the Middle Ages, they used to torture and hang crossbowmen because they said they were cowards because they stood back out of sword fighting range and just shot bolts at the knights and killed them. The person who's running the drone is in the exact same position as the crossbowman 1,000 years ago. They are choosing sides. They are willing to use violence. The difference is that they're so far removed from the actual conflict that they're virtually safe. So it doesn't require any bravery anymore. And I think there's problems with that because a natural check on violence is that you are afraid and, you know, it's like, I don't want to be here. I think, you know, and your friends are getting shot and you see the carnage. You see, I can get teary just right now remembering what some of the aftermaths of battles look like. It's awful. That's a natural check. If you're at Nellis Air Force Base and you do your job and come home with the rest of the commuters and, hi, honey, what's for dinner? Well, a meatloaf and did you have a nice day at the office? Sure. Killed 3 Taliban. Oh, good. That's nice. Johnny's got a soccer game. We've got to become way more conscious about this use of violence because the natural checks are going away.
What's the difference, do you think, between that soldier who fires a drone and kills somebody 2,000 miles away and a general who says the 4th Platoon is going to go on patrol today and their mission is vital to the success of our operation, but never goes out in the field, never sees anybody die?
I think that I would say that they're identical, even right up to the Congress and the president. The difference is that the president is using the Marine Corps as a weapon, but he's taken a side and he's using violence. Now, he doesn't risk his own life because he's so well protected. The general's one step down, but he's in the same position as the drone person. The infantryman is the one who actually is out there risking his neck to get this done. But, a Marine, battalion landing team is a president's weapon. And I don't think they believe it. I think that they think, well, we're policymakers. No, you're killing people. You're just using, paratroopers and Marines to kill them. Instead of the Marines using M16s.
The difference is they don't have to have those eyes appear in front of them as you drive down the highway 20 years later.
They don't have to pay the price. And the 19-year-old does pay the price.
So what do we do? What's the process when you come home, given the current situation? Mm-hmm. We're not training people. We're training people to obey orders.
Yes.
We're training soldiers to be fit, to fire the weapon without thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing all of that. And it's obviously not enough
from
your experience. What happens when you come home? What happens to the soldier when there's no more soldiering to be done?
Right. Well, first of all, they come back to a world that is where they don't count. You're 19, you're 20, and you count. If you don't get your job done, people die. And you come back here, and it's like, go to work for Walmart or, McDonald's. You don't even show up for work. Nobody really has. There's no consequence. So immediately, you come from a place where you count, you're really important, to a place where you don't count. That is a tough adjustment. And I think that one of the ways to get around that is to start to get people involved in activities that count. Being a father counts. Having a real job counts. And we don't help them do both of those things. The other thing is that they are going to be physically changed in their brains. PTSD is a physiological change. People think it's some kind of, you know, psychiatric issue. In combat, most deaths and casualties occur early in a tour because you're not fast. And what happens is that, you know, a normal person hears a sound, oh, and it goes through the cortex. I wonder what that is. Is that a bird? Is that the wind? By the time you work that through, you're dead. So under the huge adrenaline loads of combat, the neural pathways actually alter. It goes from the input to the amygdala. The amygdala is fight, flight, freeze. It's the reptilian part of our brain. There is no thinking. And I had this experience. I was at an intersection. It was slow off the mark, and a guy came up behind me and blasted the horn. When I came to my senses, I was on the hood of his car trying to kick his windshield in because I had been attacked, frightened, and there was no thinking. I just went into reaction mode. It was the reptile striking back. And that doesn't change. You have to learn how to cope with that. And to learn how to cope with that without doing drugs, alcohol, other kinds of violence. I mean, I have a close friend that he used to go down to bars in the black neighborhoods and shout nigger just because he just had to get himself beat up. I mean, these are weird ways of dealing with a brain physiological change that there is help for. In the last 10 or 15 years, brain science has made major increases, and we can use this to help these people. But they have to know about it, and their friends have to know about it, and their families have to know about it, and the education is lacking. We don't talk about it. So how is everybody going to know?
How many years had you been back when you had that experience?
20.
20 years?
20 years. I held on for a long time. In fact, it was a funny, I mean, when I finally ended up at this one VA therapist, I'm a Marine, so I can brag about the Marines. It's an odd way of bragging, but he says, oh, yeah, he says, yeah, the Army was in here 5 years ago. Now we're getting the Marines. It's just that hanging on, you know. And, yeah, and finally I couldn't hang on any longer. It fell apart.
So what do we do? Can you train soldiers ahead of time to know? You talk about needing a spiritual guide.
Yeah.
That's where we started this conversation.
Sure.
You need
yeah.
a spiritual guide.
I think that you
What
do.
Kind of spirit guide can
First
give you
all,
what you need to get out of this?
Well, you don't need a priest in liturgical garments. I think there are simple things that you can do that will help you retain your humanity and your connection to the spirit. That, for example, if you could just train corpsmen, who are sort of the big brothers. I mean, they're because they have to do an extra bit of training. Medics, they're usually older than the others, and you give them just a little training of how do you handle the grief of losing a friend? How do you bury the enemy? We used to throw them off the sides of the hill, and I had this one moment where I look back on it. I went, ah. Two guys in my platoon had, we'd been under attack for days, and he'd lost a lot of friends. And the dead were just down right below our fighting holes. And they had gone down and cut the ears off. Okay, they're like 18, 19 years old. It's like Letterman sweater stuff. And I had been in combat in country a long time, and I wasn't angry with them, but I knew you couldn't let that go. And so I just said, look, I know they killed your friends. You killed their friends, and you killed them. And I said, this is nothing that you should get trophies over. And so I said, I want them buried. And so I told those kids to go down and bury those two bodies. And that wasn't trivial because we were still taking sniper fire. And they went down, dug that hole, and they both started crying because they realized that they had done something over the top. And that, I'm sure, moved them forward to being able to reintegrate back into normal society because they touched what their humanity was on the spot. They didn't make them any less effective Marines. Believe me, I know those two guys. That night we were hit again, they were doing just the same job that they would have before.
But maybe because they had their grief then.
Exactly.
They didn't have to have it 5 years later.
Or 20 years later. They didn't have to be even afraid to let it come out. That's what I'm saying is that if you say, look, it's okay right after the battle when we're all safe again. Let it loose now. But that's not considered, tough, you know, and there's a lot of people are afraid that, well, then that'll just make them soft. Believe me, I know. I mean, I've been there. It doesn't make you soft. When your friends' lives and your life is at stake, you won't be soft. You will do everything you can to get the job done. And I have no fear of that. I think the people who have fear of that are probably people who have never been in combat.
Will we ever get to the point, do you think, where we can offer this kind of training?
Yes, I think we can. I mean, one of the very encouraging things is I was just at the Air Force Academy last week, and they've been reading this book there. And I was talking to the woman who's the head of, she's a one-star general, I can't remember her name, but she's the head of all Air Force Academy curriculum. And I spent an hour with her. She was trying to figure out, because she's saying, we're heading toward drones. In fact, in the big mess hall at the Air Force Academy, there used to be an airplane hanging above in the dining hall. It has been replaced by a drone. That's very symbolic. And so the killing is going to be done much more abstractly. And they are interested in this. They are trying to think about it. I was at Quantico, where they train the Marine officers. And all the instructors came in because the head of the basic school, he ordered them to come in. Only about a third of them were rolling their eyes. But they wanted to know what I was talking about. They're all combat veterans. You don't have non-combat veterans teaching new Marine officers. And they were going like, you know, we're not psychologists. We're Marines. We don't know what to do. But they were working with it. So I'm encouraged.
But they also were probably saying to themselves, we don't talk about this stuff.
Absolutely. But they did talk about it when I was there. Because, you see, I'm in the club. I mean, I've been hit. I got two Purple Hearts. I've got a Navy Cross. I'm in the club. They can talk to me. And that's a big problem. It's that sense of isolation and, like I said, fear that you'll be misunderstood. They can rip off a dark joke, and I'll know what they're doing. But you can't do that with someone who hasn't been there with you. So you have to always guard yourself. And I think that is an advantage I have. But what I'm telling them is that, you know, you're going to have to start to think about this, because even the Marines are going to get more abstract. I mean, they're not there yet, but believe me, I think in 15 years we'll have little robots that a Marine, you know, squad leader will manipulate, and it'll go around the corner and kill somebody. Technology is running fast, but the human heart doesn't keep up without really thinking about it.
Carl, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.